More Idaho Matters right now from the studios of Boise State Public Radio News. I'm Gemma Gaudet. Maybe you saw the movie starring Julia Roberts, or you read the book Eat, Pray, Love, which was an international bestseller. It sold more than 12 million copies. Author Elizabeth Gilbert has written 10 books, including her latest, City of Girls, and she's coming to Boise on May 20th for the Cabin's Readings and Conversation series. And she's joining us live for a preview. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's so nice to be here. Thank you for welcoming me.
So your book, Eat, Pray, Love, came out in 2006. However, it still resonates with readers today. When you wrote it, did you have any idea that it would have such an impact on so many people's lives, but your life and your career as well?
I think I would have had to have been like a sociopath to expect that. Or to think that, and it's been almost 20 years and I still haven't even fully processed it, because I'm not even sure how to fully process it. I'm delighted by it. I'm amazed when I meet people who the book had such an impact on, and that it continues to kind of be alive in the culture, especially given how many signs and advertisements are three words beginning with eat, you know, like eat, shop, play, eat, you know,
right.
It's kind of in the lexicon. And I think that's really funny and strange, the short answer is absolutely not. Yeah. Did I imagine that it would have such a sweep?
I mean, because for you, I would assume writing, you know, Eat, Pray, Love was really a part of your whole journey, right? And it made really, dramatic impacts on your own life. So when you look back on that time in your life, you know, when we look at Eat, Pray, Love, was there a part of that that was the most impactful, or was it all three of them combined?
Oh, wow. Those are two great questions in there. I mean, it did have a huge impact in my life. And I think the biggest for me has been its ongoing creative impact. I came into the writing of Eat, Pray, Love as a relatively young person. I was 34 when I wrote that, but I had for years written about nothing but men. I was a men's magazine journalist. I wrote for GQ. I wrote for Esquire. I wrote for Spin Magazine. I'd written three books before that, of fiction and nonfiction, both of which had the word men in the title. The last book I'd written before that was called The Last American Man. And it was about a woodsman and the true life story of a woodsman living in the mountains of North Carolina. Like, I had always been very focused on being a female author who was fascinated by men's journeys. And so when I went to write Eat, Pray, Love, it was a real departure for me. I mean, not only did I not think that it would be so successful, I thought that I was really sabotaging myself. And yet I had to do it. Like, emotionally, I had to do it. And the feeling I had as I was writing it was, sorry that I have to take a moment to tell this story. I'll come back later to writing, you know, books about men, I guess, is what I thought I was supposed to be doing. And then instantly I became like the chick lit queen, you know, and I've never gone back to writing about men or being, you know, even that particularly interested in men's journeys. And I do find it fascinating that, that prior to that, I also got a lot of award nominations and I was taken a little bit more seriously. But then when I wrote about a woman's journey, it was an interesting, a little bit of a come down, but I traded all of that prestige for millions of female readers, and that's who I write for now, and that's who I care about.
Well, so and to the point that you have a new book out, and it's called City of Girls. So
exactly,
so talk to us about this newest book.
So that's a novel that's set in the New York City theater world in around World War II. And it's a book that I've wanted to write for a very long time because it's about promiscuous girls, and it's fiction, but it's based on a lot of showgirls in their 90s and even 100s who I met when I was researching the book, and the truly wild lives that they were living in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. As one of them said to me, everybody likes to think that the sexual revolution was invented in the 1960s, but we got there before everybody else. And I really wanted to write about girls who were really, in terms of polite society, quite out of control, but who at the same time were living in a very free way, within a culture that was not necessarily that free. So it is a freewheeling book about showgirls and dancers and actresses kind of burning their way through their youth and through New York City in the 1940s. And it was really fun to research and really fun to write.
I was going to say, what did you really enjoy about writing this and bringing these characters to life, in particular about talking to these, former showgirls, as you said, in their 90s and even 100 years old? I mean, that itself had to have been just a fascinating experience.
Well, yeah, because we're taught, I mean, people tend to take decades and put a stamp on them for what that decade was about. And I think we then somehow believe that that's the only thing that was going on. The 1930s was a depression. The 1940s, everybody went and worked in factories. All the women went and worked in factories to help with the war. This is the shorthand version of reality. And then in the 1950s, everybody got married and had babies and wore poodle skirts, right? And moved to the suburbs. But there have always been girls and women who have lived outside of culture, outside of what was instructed. And so to meet these women who are in their 90s and sometimes older, and to have them tell me about these free-for-all lives that they were living. I mean, one of the women that I met, whose name was Norma Amigo, and she was a showgirl who was still living in the same rent-control apartment that she'd moved into in 1952. And
Man,
had
good
a
for her.
series. I mean, she was still gorgeous. I know, no kidding. And she's still gorgeous in her late 90s. And she just told me about like the series of lovers she had had her whole life. And she said, my policy was always the door is open. You can come into my life. You can leave. She said, I never wanted to marry. I never wanted to be a parent. I just wanted to have these experiences and to make sure that everybody knew that they were free. And that's not something I associate with 1954, even in New York City. But she was doing it, and meeting her really gave me the permission to tell that story in the book.
You know what's interesting about that, though, is that I think even today, right, 2024, if a woman were to say that, there would still be this backlash of almost a selfishness, right? So even though you put this book at a different time, I mean, how much did you know your own lived experience as a woman right now, or even just women in general, in what's going on in our culture and climate right now, play into, writing this book about women who do live outside the bounds?
Well, ever since Eat, Pray, Love, especially, I do feel like if I have a mission, it's somebody once told me that I was a walking permission slip, and I try to be that, to lead by example for that too in women's lives, like that you are not required to live by the still very narrow template. I mean, the bounds of respectability for women have not changed much over time, and no matter how much we might wish, there's a bit more freedom, but as you say, you would still be shamed and shunned and judged. And so I'm constantly trying to put out ideas out there about different ways of life, even choosing as I've chosen not to have children. That's still something that you'll be judged for. And I'm constantly trying to remind people that it's a perfectly legitimate decision. Going back to the showgirl Norma Amigo, she came from a very conservative Catholic family in Chicago. And she told me that her siblings to this day are angry at her for the unconventional life that she's lived. And they keep saying, you're really going to regret it when you get old and you don't have children or a husband to take care of you. And she's sitting there gorgeous, still going to dance class every day at the YMCA, 98 years old. And she's like, I keep waiting to regret it, but it hasn't happened
Hasn't happened
yet.
yet.
It hasn't happened yet. I'll definitely call you if those regrets arise. And, so I think it's really important to tell those stories because, even today, in what we might allegedly call a post-feminist world, there's still tremendous shame that women experience when their marriages fail, for instance. And I'm always here to remind people that that's okay too. Not easy, but it's okay, and it happens. Or if they don't live inside of the lines. So
Well, and
yeah, I try to tell a broader story of women's lives.
Well, and I think too, in particular that point about choosing not to have children, there is still such stigma around that for women, not around men, but women about making that choice. And I think that sometimes people don't realize that it is a choice for some women. I mean, I have a sister who has chosen not to have children, and I will tell you, I think it is the most right decision for her. I grew up with her. I am not surprised by that decision. And in fact, I mean, I would have been more shocked if she had decided to be a parent. Yet still, the backlash that she has been, you know, that she's gotten, even within our family in some ways, right, about making that choice, I tend to find it to be an incredibly brave choice. So in your writing, in particular, you know, with subjects like that, you know, is that present, you know, in your consciousness when you are writing these stories?
Well, certainly with City of Girls, it was, because as a reader, not only as a writer, but as a reader, you know, as a woman reader, I some of my favorite books, some of the world's favorite books, are the story, the classical story of the ruined woman. Daisy Buchanan and Hedda Gabler and Anna Karenina and Camille, all the operas, you know, it's like, it
right.
makes for
yeah,
a great
every
story.
Single one, right?
It's like every single one of them. I mean, it's great drama, and it makes for, and I love so many of those stories. But you know, after a while, just in terms of like sort of female to female solidarity, one gets exhausted of watching one woman after another go down for having lust, for having passion, for having desire, you know, and the messaging that comes across through those books is one false move and you're dead. You know, you're going to end up in the gutter with your throat cut, or you're going to be ruined or cast out of society. And one thing I have learned from life, and the scary messaging of that, is women cannot afford to make a mistake. If you make a mistake, you'll be ruined. And not only do I not think that's true in this day and age, I'm not sure that it has ever been fully true, because if it were true that women cannot survive their sometimes terrible, terrible judgment around romance and sex, there wouldn't be a woman left alive in this world, right? Like, we survive it. We can survive ourselves. We can survive our bad decision-making, you know, and not only survive, but as I try to show in the book, come out on the other side, perhaps a more weathered, interesting person, you know, shaped by your own life. And so it was really intentional for me to want to tell that story.
Yeah. Do you still travel quite a bit, don't you? I mean, you've had workshops really all over the world, Mexico, Toronto, Australia this year. You know, is that still a big part of your life?
It is. I just got back. I did a month of speaking and teaching workshops across Europe, and I still get a thrill. Like, there were, you know, places on that trip that I've still never been. It was my first time in Copenhagen. It was my first time in Manchester, England. Like, I mean, I like going to see new things, you know, and mm-hmm. I was introducing some of the people I was traveling with to a game that I like to play when I'm in a new city or a new place. And it's called Most Interesting Path. And it's especially easier to do it now that you have a phone with GPS that will take you back to your hotel. But I've played this my whole life, which is you step out of the door of the new place, and then you look to the left, you look to the right, you look straight ahead, and you choose what looks to be the most interesting path. And at every intersection, you do that for a couple hours. And it's my, you know, I'd still rather do that than go to a museum or take a tour of a beautiful building. Like, to just wander and allow your curiosity to pull you along. And if you're playing with a friend, you take turns. So at each intersection, so I was doing this with a friend of mine in Cologne, Germany, because I'd never been there, and she was traveling with me. And so we'd be like, okay, your turn, which direction looks more interesting to you? We'll go that way. And I think that's somewhat how I've lived my life, not only in terms of traveling, but also in terms of the decisions that I've made. And most interesting path doesn't necessarily always mean easiest or least painful, but it definitely means most interesting. And I think there's something to be said for that.
Well, we are so looking forward to you coming to Boise next week. So I just really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to chat with us before then.
Thank you. I'm so looking forward to it. I'm going to play Most Interesting Path when I get to Boise, because let's see what's there.
Well, and I'm sure you will discover something fascinating. I can guarantee it. But thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We've been talking with New York Times bestselling author Elizabeth Gilbert. She's the author of Eat, Pray, Love. She's coming to Boise's Morrison Center May 20th as part of the Cabin's Readings and Conversation series, talking about her latest novel, City of Girls. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.